Sairam, dear listeners, it's a beautiful Thursday evening yet again. So joining you live from our studios in Prashant and Ilium yet again is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. This is Radio Sai Answering Booth, a place where you can drop your queries, doubts, worries and confusions. And together we can explore Swami's message for guidance and clarity. I have another very thought-provoking question today from a regular listener. And I'm sure we will have much to learn today, or at least refresh what we've already learned. But as always, let us begin by offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Before we head to the question we have to deal with today, permit me to share with all of you a beautiful quote. This is a quote by an American writer by name Rick Hawker. I quote, "True devotion is motivated by love alone and devoid of selfish entanglements." End of quote. Swami would often say that we all have love in our hearts, and depending on to whom it is directed, it gets a different name. So the same love towards a child becomes vatsalyam or motherly love. When towards an equal, it becomes friendship. When directed towards one's partner, it becomes anuragam or romantic love. And when that same love is directed towards God, it becomes bhakti. But of course, Swami says bhakti is love mixed with respect as we acknowledge that God is supreme. But still, the basis is always love. But many people have fear as the predominant emotion in devotion. Why? If God gets upset, He will take away something or will not give something that I've been seeking. But this can never be devotion, because this is showing respect with some kind of benefit in mind. This is just subordination, what we display before our bosses and superiors, isn't it? True devotion is love that is a spontaneous expression, not because there is something to receive, where the devotee can say, "I love God because He is lovable, and I love God because I cannot help but love Him." Very similar to what Professor Kasturi says in his book, The Loving God, or Loving God. The title of the book itself is quite interesting. It's suggestive of a dual meaning, isn't it? Where loving could be seen as a verb and as an adjective, both giving two completely different meanings, and both meanings can be considered as suitable titles for the book that he's written. And going back to what he says in that book, he says, "I don't love Swami because I am to gain something from Him. I don't even seek His love in return. I love Him because He's the most lovable person I have ever known." Well, that is true bhakti. Not that we don't love Swami like that, just that I think our love has some impurities. That's about all. As we draw out all selfishness from this love that we feel for Swami, the love becomes more and more perfect and becomes perfect eventually. But when that happens, the Lord Himself becomes us, for bhakti itself means oneness. So one who loves with no desires, interestingly, eventually gets everything. So before we head to the question for this week, permit me, dear listeners, to read that quote by Rick Hawker one more time. I quote, "True devotion is motivated by love alone and devoid of selfish entanglements." Let's head to the question that we have for this week. As I said, it's an interesting, thought-provoking one. It's from one of our regular listeners, Ms. Aruna Narayanan from California. And I'm very grateful to her that she sent the question in her own voice. So I'll play out the question. There are a lot of things there. We'll listen to it. At the end of it, I'll try to summarize what she's asking. And let's see what we can come up with as an answer to that question.
Sairam, Prem, thank you for answering a lot of questions in the answering booth, and you are enabling so many people like me to understand Swami's messages very clearly. Thank you so much. I also have a question. I would like to know if self-respect is a form of ego, or what is the difference? I'm going through situations at work where people put me down, or they say, "Hey, you're not performing well." And, you know, there are situations that I get hurt. So should I be defending myself? Is that bringing back self-respect? I read Swami's discourse where he says, Abraham Lincoln, he followed his mother's teachings and got self-confidence and self-respect, and that earned him, gained respect from all the people, and he reached heights. So in my situation, when people accuse me of something, how should I be responding? Should I explain the situation, saying, you know, this is what happened? But sometimes I do feel that, oh, you know, why should I be saying all this? I should only take the good feedback from whatever they are saying, and I keep quiet and I think to myself and I don't explain my situation. By doing that, I sometimes wonder if people make the assumption that, yeah, she seems to be agreeing to what I'm saying. So, you know, all these confusions arise in my mind. So what would be a person of self-respect saying or doing in, you know, situations where they get feedback which hurts them, which, you know, you think it is not quite true? If you can clarify Swami's message, that will be very helpful. Thank you so much once again, Sairam.
So that was the question, and thanks to Ms. Aruna for expressing it so clearly for us. As I see it in that question, there are three interrelated themes. One, of course, is what is self-respect and how is it different from ego, right? That's the first aspect of that question. The second one is dealing with criticism without getting the ego involved. How do you deal with criticism, protecting your self-respect but not getting your ego involved? And the third one is, when should we respond to criticism with an explanation and when should we ignore it? And as I said, all these three is in the backdrop of this idea of what is self-respect and how do you go about protecting it and how is it different from asserting your ego? It's a very interesting topic where we've dealt with similar themes before, especially the differentiation between ego and self-confidence was one question. I think I'll make a few references to that answer that we, which I had given during that that program. But this concept itself is very, very important. I think even we've dealt with this theme of difference between self-respect and ego as part of one of the afternoon satsangs. But of course, this is in the backdrop of facing criticism at work, right? That's a very specific idea. Well, if you've been a regular listener of Radio Sai Answering Booth, you know that the answer is not going to be in three sentences or four sentences. I think brevity is no more a virtue I can claim. But hopefully, through the answer, we will be able to get a little understanding of what is this concept, because it's a very, very important theme. So what is this self-respect to start with? Putting it very simply, respect is what others think of you or the value that others give you. And self-respect is what you think of yourself or how you value yourself. That's the simplest way I can put it. So when I say self-respect is the respect I have for myself, it invariably comes down to this idea of self that I have for myself, right? What is my idea of who I am invariably becomes the center of this concept of self-respect itself. And as Swami would say, you're not one but three. What others think you are, what you think you are, and what you really are. That's what Swami would say. And as I was saying, this is quite similar to what we had answered in respect to self-confidence versus respect. And in that course, I had made this mention that the idea of self-confidence changes with the idea of the self itself. And our self-confidence becomes more and more perfect when our idea of the self starts tending towards perfection. So when does the idea of self become perfect? When through maturity and spiritual understanding, right? That's how the idea of self becomes perfect. And when I say perfect, it means more and more we believe that When I say self, it refers to this true self and not what I think I am or not what others think I am, right? It gradually gravitates towards more of the idea that I am the true self. So when through spiritual maturity or spiritual sadhana, this idea of self becomes perfect, the idea of I am this body-mind complex begins to reduce. And the idea that I am this atmic self increases. That is the idea of perfection of the self. So same is the case when we talk about self-respect too. Self-respect, the concept, changes with our idea of the self. And it starts becoming perfect when our idea of the self becomes perfect. Till then, I think there will be a little bit of body consciousness involved in the equation. And when there is body consciousness, there will be ego. So we will constantly be having a tinge of ego operating along with self-respect till our idea of self is perfect. You cannot take that away. So the only thing we can do is use our idea of the self at any given time to try and propagate self-respect and diminish the, more importantly, the detrimental outcomes of ego. We don't straight away try to uproot ego. Of course, that is the overall idea of every spiritual exercise. But the practical way of doing it is try to diminish the detrimental outcome of ego at that particular point, right? And this process itself will lead to the perfection of our concept of self eventually, because this is the whole spiritual struggle that each one of us are undertaking. So let us see how this is done. And for that, again, we'll have to start with our idea of self right now, right? We're not talking about the ideal idea of self or the most basal idea of self that we are the body. But right now, our idea of the self, as I said, when I think of myself, it is a mix of my real self, who I think I am, and what I think others think of me, right? I'm only talking about my idea of myself. So I'm saying that it is my real self, the idea that I think I am, and this idea of what I think others think of me, right? This is a very important thing to, it's a little tweak from what Swami has said. This becomes important when we are talking about self-respect. I hope that will become clear as we go through the answer. And these are not just very philosophical concepts and they do not have any practical implications in our life. Actually, each one of these have a practical way in which it plays out in our life. And I think that's what we're going to see. And as we always say, the whole idea of this program is not to talk about pure philosophy. We should be able to use it in our everyday life, right? And we will see that the idea of self, all of these three things, their practical implications, how they help us to decide what is the action that we need to do, because that comes into play when you're talking about how do you deal with criticism, and our idea of self-respect itself, which is the overall concept on which the question is based. So, as I said, let's start with what I think of myself and how it forms my basic idea of self-respect. So when I ask myself, who am I? One of the most simplest answers I can come up with is, I'm a human being, right? That's probably the starting point, we can say, in many ways. So there is this idea of human dignity which goes with this concept that I am a human being, right? And this human dignity is something that we always try to protect. And on top of this idea that I'm a human being, there are these very basic identities like, you know, my age, my gender, the idea of relative status in society, all the kind of labels that we have, right? You know, I'm a mother, or I am a woman of respect. I'm a person who is in such and such a position in the company, or I'm a Swami's student, or I'm a Swami's devotee, right? All of these things are statuses that we've given ourselves, even people around us look at us with these statuses. So these are things which partially what I think I am and what others think of me also, right? But most often these are very general attributes which whoever possesses, we are supposed to give a certain amount of respect to it. For instance, take the idea of age, right? Suppose I'm an elderly person and I expect people to respect my age, right? This is not because it is me, it is because of this idea that I'm elderly. So when that is the case, when I see an elderly person, I treat him with respect, right? Similarly, something like the position of hierarchy within an organization. I see my boss, I treat him with respect. Or some certain professions which automatically draw our respect. A teacher, for that matter, or someone who is in a position who can impart knowledge to us. Right? These are all things that we are expected to show respect, and you know, these are basic cultural ideas that we respect age, we respect teachers, we respect our parents. So when we carry any of these attributes, we expect that others should respect us. So how do I know if I'm expecting respect from others out of genuine self-respect and not of ego? There are two ways in which we can ensure that this is self-respect and not ego. One is, I am immaterial, as I just explained, right? When I said that these are attributes, whoever possesses them, whoever is an elderly person, whoever is a teacher, whoever is a person who is in a position which is higher in a hierarchical system, right? Whoever possesses these are meant to be respected. So I actually am immaterial, right? So whoever possesses these attributes, I would expect the same respect. I would give them the respect, and I would expect others to respect this person as much as I would expect others to respect me when I carry those attributes. In other words, if there was another person with these same attributes for which I expect to be respected, then I will respect that person, right? This is a very, very important point, and this is probably one of the key definitions of self-respect itself. For example, if I value human dignity, as we all must value, right? As I said, it starts off with the basic idea that I'm a human being. I will value another person's human dignity as much. Let's say I'm walking on the road and I'm seeing a half-naked beggar on the road. I will not throw food at him. I will not treat him like, I will not throw money at him. There is a certain human dignity that I have to respect, even though I might not treat that person like a guest who has come to my house. I will treat that person differently. But at the same time, there will be a basic human dignity with which I will treat this person, right? Because, as I said, it doesn't matter who is having that attribute. Whoever is having that attribute, that same level of respect and dignity has to be, offered to that person. And, oftentimes Swami would tell this when we were students. He would say that, you're a Swami's student, so don't demean yourself, which means you have to carry yourself with a certain amount of respect. It is not wrong to expect a certain amount of respect when you're associated with Swami in that sense. Right? I mean, just as a very casual example, see, many times when some of us are invited to talk to a gathering or address a gathering, it's not that we expect you to show respect to me as an individual, but nevertheless, we will try to protect the dignity that goes with this label that I'm carrying. I go there as a Swami's representative, so I would expect a certain amount of respect to be given to that label. It's not about me at all. And when I'm speaking to an audience, I don't want respect for me, but I want respect for the role that I'm playing at that particular moment, which is I'm sharing some thoughts, right? I am there in a position where I am the speaker, I am sharing some thoughts. So I am not expecting you to respect me as an individual, but I'm asking for respect for that role that I'm playing. And as I was saying, how will I know that it's not ego? Let's say when there is a reversal of roles, I am sitting in the audience and you're the speaker, I will respect you the same way I expected to be respected, right? That's the simplest way we can make out that this is self-respect and it's not a form of ego. I had read this very small incident sometime back, very interesting one incident where, it was during darshan time and Swami was walking around in the portico. There's this middle portico, what we call. I don't know if devotees will be able to relate to that terminology. The Ganesha statue is there in the front of the mandir. There's a corridor between the Ganesha statue wall and, bhajan hall. There is an elevated space, which is the higher portico, and then there's the lower portico. And Swami would spend a lot of time walking up and down this place, talking to students and the staff and devotees there. lot of very, very valuable interactions would happen there. So this was one occasion when Swami was walking around there doing darshan. And I think there was one of these boys who was standing probably in the second row. I'm sorry, not standing. He was sitting in the second row. He was probably holding a letter, or Swami wanted to speak to him. So Swami called him. And in that moment when Swami called him, he literally leapt over the professor who was sitting in front of him and, you know, crossed him over, which is considered a little disrespectful thing to do, especially if there's an elderly person who's sitting there. You're not supposed to walk over that person, even though you're not actually stepping on him. Even to cross over that thing, that person, is considered a little disrespectful. But this boy, you know, in that moment when Swami called him, he just literally leapt over this professor who was sitting there and he went up to Swami. So see the way Swami responded to this small act. First, Swami reprimanded that student and Swami said, you know, this is a very disrespectful act. You should not do this. You should not step over your elders this way. And then Swami turned to that elderly teacher who was sitting there and he told him that you should tell the student that this is not the right way to behave. Why are you keeping quiet? Why are you putting up with this? And this teacher, you know, very sweetly smiled and told Swami, Swami, it's okay. You know, he's a small boy and after all, he's my student. I didn't take offense to it. And then Swami explained that, see, it's not about you feeling slighted or not. He's doing something which is disrespectful to an elder. And you should tell him and you should correct him because you are in the position of a teacher. Right? So Swami is telling, I'm not asking you to reprimand him because it is you. I'm asking you to reprimand him because that act being performed, whoever it may be, the elderly person who is there, it was wrong. And so you should tell him. You know, when I read this incident, I thought it was a very, very subtle lesson that Swami was teaching. See, you can be asserting your ego even when you think that you're being soft and kind. I mean, that is the subtle lesson that Swami is teaching. Swami was saying that, look, he did not slight you, but he did an act that was disrespectful to any elder. It may not be, tomorrow it may be somebody else there. And being an elder and teacher, being somebody who has that role to explain these things to children, it is your duty to explain to him. So one of the easy ways to check if we are doing something out of ego or whether it is out of self-respect is to check if this idea of I or this identity of me being there matters. Am I getting upset because it is being done to me? Or it does not matter if it is me or anyone, this act is wrong and so I am reacting, right? So will I respect someone else in my place is another way of looking at it, right? I am expecting people to respect me. So if somebody else is there, will I respect that person? Will I respect this person the same way I expect others to respect me when I'm in that place? Right? Honestly, if you ask me, most often it is a mix, right? We do take, especially criticism of somebody speaking something rudely or harshly to us, we do take it personally and it's always there because, as I said, as long as there is body consciousness, there will be a little bit of ego. We cannot wish that away. But there is a way in which that ego, even when it is there, has to be dealt with. I think that is something which we'll come to later. So this is one of the very, very important ways by which we can check for ourselves. Are we really asserting our ego or is it a form of self-respect that we are trying to protect? So as I said, one way is to check if this I is immaterial in that equation. The second and the more important thing is, you know, we will ourselves give due respect to that particular attribute or that particular role by aligning our actions in a manner that befits that role or status. I think this is probably much, much more important than the first point that I made. I will act like a human. I will act in a manner that befits my age. When I say I am a Sai student and I expect others to respect me, I will act in a manner that a Sai student is meant to act. Right? If I am a Sai devotee, I will act in a manner that befits this label of a Sai devotee. As I said, Swami would say, don't demean yourself, right? Which is, in another sense, that don't act in a manner that does not befit the status of what you are holding, right? Similarly, if I am a boss, it does not mean that my role is to boss around. If I'm a boss, the role that I have to play is that of a leader. So if I'm a boss, am I really behaving like a leader, right? So it is not only expecting others to respect me. It is not only me respecting others if they are in that position. Am I respecting my own attribute by living up to that name, right? This is what is the problem with most of us, as Swami would say. Most of us want respect that is due, but we are not prepared to respect it ourselves by acting accordingly. Swami would say this, you know, when teachers and parents and elders, they don't behave in an ideal way that befits their age and their status, then automatically they lose respect in the eyes of the youngsters and the students. So merely by holding a position or playing a particular role, we can't claim respect in that sense. When we start leading a life that is in accordance to that status or attribute that we are holding, then we will get true respect. And as I said, this is one of the most important aspects of self-respect. I have absolutely no control over others respecting me or not, right? I cannot, there's only a certain level to which it can work, which I'll come to shortly, but I have very less control over what others think of me and how, whether they are respecting me of. So that has a very, very limited role to play in my actions as well as how I look at them. But I have complete control over how much respect I have for myself. And one of the most important manner in which we have to express this respect is act in a manner that befits that status. Now that we've come to the idea of acting that part and what is the action part in this idea of self-respect, I think let me carry on from here and speak about the correlation between the actions that we perform and this idea of self-respect. And then eventually we'll come to this idea of people's opinion, which is also a very important aspect of self-respect and how it plays an important role in our idea of self-respect. Let us take your specific case, the case that the questioner was speaking about, of the work that you're doing, which you're, you know, you made a reference to when you perform your duties. First, it is defined by what you think your role is, right? If I am working in a place, what is my role according to my idea? It all starts with that, my idea of what am I supposed to do in this particular position that I am. So what needs to be done is act as perfectly as you can based on your idea of your roles and responsibilities. That is the first step in that position that you are in. And while you're doing this, this has to be done with the conscience as a touchstone. Adhering to the conscience is one of the most important things, even as you live up to the role as you see as your role. So when you do this, one, the aspect of the self, which is who you think you are, is represented by what you define as your role. The one you really are is defined by your conscience in this particular situation. So now when it comes to action, what others think you are is also important, because in a way that further defines the role that you're meant to play. So that's why I said these three things of who you really are and what you think you are and what others think you are have a practical implication on how we carry about our work, right? Let's say I'm inducted into a particular team. I may genuinely think that my role is such and such, but the management which has inducted me into that team may have a different idea of what role I'm supposed to play. They have a different expectation based on which they've hired me, and it could many times happen that they might have a larger vision of what I'm supposed to do or the way I fit into that particular team. So in such a case, I cannot say that, look, I'm not bothered about what others think of me. I'm only bothered about what I think is my role. Right? What others think of me also becomes important to, that also needs to be factored in, because that defines my role in that case. I cannot say that I will go by what I think I'm supposed to do and I will not let anybody else question me. So I will have to factor in others' expectations also, because that helps me define my role better. I'm a son because someone is a mother and father. I'm an employee because someone is an employer. So people around me, the roles that they play, their opinions, their expectations, to a certain extent, to a limited extent, helps me define my actions. What am I supposed to do right now, right? But all through, the touchstone is always the conscience. People may expect all kinds of things from us, right? you might have a boss who might expect you to do something which is immoral, expect you to, you know, do something which is outside what is expected of you. So every time you actually go back to this conscience and see that, you ensure that it is within the bounds of that morality or that conscience. First of all, we already filter people's expectations of us through our own limitations. There are only a certain things that we can do. We have our own limitations. We have our own, how much we can give to that particular activity. So first of all, that is the first level of filter anyway. But constantly on the base of all of these decisions should be this touchstone of conscience. Is it acceptable to our conscience? Right? So going back to what we started with, our idea of self is who I really am plus who I think I am plus who others think I am. And in this, the most important is to act according to who I really am, which is the conscience. And then I must live up to my own expectations of myself. That is the second most important thing. And the least important, but still important nevertheless, because it helps me define my role better, is what others think of me and what others have expectations of me. So now let us see how self-respect is related to all of what I spoke till now about the different kinds of actions that we do and where we actually lose balance or where we have to try to bring balance. Most of us end up just reversing this order of importance that I had spoken about when it comes to self-respect. What do I mean by that? We give maximum importance to what others think of us. We build our own self-image based on what others think of us and how we are able to impress others. And when we do this, this eventually makes our life empty because we are not defining what we are supposed to do. Even if we are doing that, we are defining it purely based on what others think I am supposed to be doing. The other extreme or the other way we can go out of balance is we say, I don't care about others. I will do what I want. In other words, we do not give importance to our responsibilities as seen in the larger picture. We close ourselves to feedback from outside and we will in this manner end up asserting only our ego because we are only asserting this idea of who I think I am. I'm not bothered about my conscience. I'm not bothered about what you think I am. I am only asserting what I think I am, which is nothing but the body consciousness or the ego, right? So the right way is define our roles as we see it. Take the opinion of others as an aid to define more clearly our role and then act accordingly all the time, keeping the conscience as the touchstone. As, you know, talking about self-respect and how self-respect fits into all of this, there's a beautiful quote that Mahatma Gandhi would often say, you know, whenever you talk about self-respect, there's one thing which always comes to my mind. He would say that no one can take away your self-respect if you choose not to give it away. No one can take your self-respect away from you if you choose not give it away, right? The problem with all of us is we choose to give it away so easily. And how do we choose to give it away so easily? We let others define our self-respect. Right? I'm not saying that others' respect is not important at all, but that is something which will automatically come and that will eventually come as we lead the life the way I was saying, that define your roles and take feedback from others to define your roles better and constantly keep yourself aligned to that conscience where you're acting to ensure that you're living up to what you have defined as your role. In many aspects of life, I think we do this mistake of putting, putting the cart before the horse. Especially in education, we often do this mistake. In schools, how the process was meant to be is completely reversed. What was the initial way the processes in the schools were meant to be? There is a certain syllabus for that particular class that needs to be learned. How will it be learned? By following a certain curriculum. A curriculum is set up how this particular chunk of knowledge is dispensed to the students. There's a curriculum set up for that. And how do we know if the task of learning has been accomplished satisfactorily? At the end of the year, we have an exam. And so what is the role of this exam at the end of the year? If I have sincerely followed the curriculum and if I have covered the syllabus and I have learnt what was meant to be learnt, this exam will reflect that, right? This exam will show a result which shows that, all right, this is, you have done 60% of what needs to be learnt, you have learnt, or 70% of what needs to be learnt, you have learnt. So that becomes an indication of how I have gone about this process of learning, right? But now what do we do in schools? We have what we refer to as exam-oriented preparation, right? The idea is not about learning, but scoring well in the exam. So what happens? The curriculum itself gets skewed to ensure good results in the exam. And when that happens, the process of learning becomes a casualty. So what was meant to be a form of judging if the process of learning has happened, which was an exam, has become the center of the process itself. So we are, our preparation has become exam-centric, our approach to the curriculum itself has become exam-centric, so learning becomes a casualty. And I think we are doing the same thing in life too. How am I saying this? Look, when we are living our life, I'm supposed to live a life, first of all, morally, ethically, and responsibly. Right? That's how we are supposed to live our life. So what should I do for that? I play my role in society to the best of my ability, guided by my conscience. That's how I'm supposed to lead my life. The respect that I will eventually earn in society is an indication that I have led my life this way, in a respectable manner, following my conscience and living up to the roles and responsibilities that have been assigned to me. In other words, if I have acted in a way I can look at myself in the mirror and feel respectable, others will also show that respect to me. But just like how we have done in schools and in the context of education, now we strive directly only for others respecting us. Our self-respect is completely based on not if I am living up to my own potentials and my own dignity, but whether others are respecting me or not. So what do I do in life? What I strive for, what I achieve, is all with an eye on whether others will respect me when I obtain this thing or when I secure this thing. So you'll earn others' respect, right? Even in this manner, if you're doing some things, I mean, this is how most of our lives happen in the city. We buy big houses, we buy big cars, we acquire education, all the while thinking that if I have all of this, people will respect me, people will look up to me, right? Our eye is on how people will look at us, right? And when we go about life like this, yes, we will earn respect in a way. But what I said in the beginning will not happen, which is we progressing spiritually and this idea of myself becoming perfect, which can happen through this process if it is carried out properly, that will not happen. But it goes back to the same question of I was saying that do we not earn respect in this manner? Do we not earn respect by having an approach which is skewed in this manner? Yes, we will earn respect in that manner. In fact, going back to the same example of an exam, if you have an exam-oriented preparation, exam-oriented curriculum, yes, you will show well in the exam. You will score well in the exam, and that's what's happening to all of us. I mean, self-included. We have good numbers to show in our exams because we prepared for the exam that way. But now what that exam shows as a result is a poor reflection of this learning process, which was meant to be the central idea of schooling, first of all. Right, so the exam shows that I've cleared mathematics with 90%. Can I claim that I've learnt 90% of the syllabus which was given there? Probably not, because I have very, very smartly I've learnt in such a way that I can get that 90% in that exam, right? So the same thing happens even in our life. We do earn respect. People do look at us and give us respect and accord us that respect, and we build our self-respect on the basis of that. But this respect now becomes a very untrue image of the true self-respect that we have built in the process, right? So similarly, Swami says that people can gain respect by doing such things that people will look at and respect them, but it is, in one way, it is short-lived, right? Eventually, it will wither away. But if we hold on to our self-respect without bothering about others, whether they are respecting us or not, and eventually we will earn the respect of others in this process. Because we would have led a respectable life, and eventually people look at us and say that, yeah, this is a person who is worthy of my respect. He's lived his life in a very clean manner. He's been a very ethical person. He's been a very moral person. And he has contributed to society in the way it is expected of him, or it is expected of her. And eventually people will respect. And that is why Swami says that, you know, it is not striving merely for respect, but Swami would say it is striving for, the word in Sanskrit is kirti, or a name which stands. It's not just a fleeting respect, but somebody will say that, you know, this person is a person who has a good name, has good fame, right? The word which Swami uses is kirti. So when we have led our life in such a manner that we protect our self-respect in this way, the way I've told how we act, we give respect to our status first of all by acting in accordance to that, and we lead our life in accordance to our conscience and tweak our idea of what are our roles and responsibility by constantly taking only limited feedback from outside. You know, we are not completely living for others, but we use that feedback from others, we use that opinion from others to fine-tune what we are supposed to do. If we have led our life this way, Swami says, eventually you will learn what is referred to as kirti, or good name or good fame. And Swami would say, there's a very, very famous padyam in Sanskrit which Swami would chant, where Swami says, satyam kirti dvayam stiram. He says, kirti is, Swami is raising it to the level of truth itself. Swami says, truth and this fame are the only ones which will stand the test of time. And such self-respect, or such respect from others, will be got if we lead our life in such a manner that we foster this self-respect. And I think that was the self-respect that Abraham Lincoln's mother taught him, right? And that's the kind of self-respect that Swami alludes to also. When we lead our life, we give respect to the status that we have. We uphold our human dignity. And in the same manner, we give the same respect to others, right? These two have to happen side by side. First of all, we act in accordance to the status that we are holding, and we respect others, whoever is holding that particular status. We respect that person, we respect age, we respect status to a limited extent. We respect human dignity in that sense, right? So this is what I think Swami referred to in the case of the beautiful lesson that Abraham Lincoln's mother taught him, because she tells him that, you know, he comes back home, that beautiful analogy with Swami, the beautiful episode that Swami would often narrate. He comes back home one day saying that, you know, all my friends are teasing me, that my clothes are dirty and I'm a very poor person. So that's when the mother tells him that, you know, see, these are all external factors. You cannot build your self-respect based on how others look at you. You know, you have a certain way of looking at yourself. And so, and she teaches him how to build that self-respect and act according to that self-respect. And we all know that eventually he really did earn that self-respect. It took him time. Probably he might not have earned the self-respect within the same class, but eventually he earns that time. And the same thing happens even in our exams, right? If I've not done exam-oriented preparation, I might get lesser than the person who has done an exam-oriented preparation. But eventually there'll be enough number of examinations in time, not only in the form of the exams in school, but the process of life itself, the way you will be looked at, the way your learning will be judged, all of that will eventually make you show your true worth of learning, rather than, you know, the skewed process by which we attack the process of judgment as the central idea. The way that skews the process itself is avoided, and we are looking at the learning-oriented idea. And similarly, we look at the self-respected oriented idea rather than defining the self-respect purely based on others, the way others look at us. But what I said in the beginning was, you know, ego is, I was making a reference to that other question that I had answered, which was the self-confidence and ego, and I think I had defined ego pretty elaborately in that. I'll not go back into that entire definition again. But generally speaking, I had explained that ego is not just pride or arrogance in that sense, but it's a much, much more fundamental idea of identification. When you say that I am so-and-so, that self that false identification of ourself, right? What we think is our personality or what we think we are. That is what is eventually the ego. And it is in the foundation of this idea that even this concept of self-respect is built. As I said, when we say self-respect, it's a combination of who we really are, what we think we are, and what we believe others look at us as. When that ego is completely removed, then I don't see myself as having any attributes at all. I don't see myself as I'm a boss or I'm so-and-so or I'm a Swami student or Swami's devotees. I am able to associate myself purely with that true self, right? So my idea of self is only what I really am. So in that case, my self-respect is only because I am I, as Swami would say. And as I had explained earlier, since there is no ego whatsoever, there's no reason for me to not respect myself or me to look at others to respect me. And automatically when I'm respecting myself purely because of my association with true self, I will respect everybody equally. It doesn't matter whether he's a beggar on the road or he's the prime minister of the country or anything in that point, right? But till this point, this ego has to be utilized. Till that point where that ego is completely removed and I'm able to associate myself with that absolute self that I am, this ego will be there and it needs to be utilized. So that is the next question, or in the next few minutes, that's what I'll be speaking about. How do we utilize this ego? The whole process I explained, you know, is we are using the ego to define our actions, right? One of the ways we do that is we attach this ego to nobler attributes. As Swami would say, you know, instead of saying that I am a sinner, Swami says, I am a noble person or I am a noble being. As Swami would say, I am the soul which is entrapped in this ephemeral body. Or as simple as, I am a Sai devotee. Swami would say that you're using the same ego. This ego needs to attach itself to something. So you attach it to something nobler, and that is the status that you keep for yourself. And now you start doing actions in accordance to that definition that you've given to yourself. So this way, what we are actually doing is, we are controlling the tamasic expressions of ego, which could eventually show up as pride, or for that matter, even low self-esteem, through the idea of sattva, right? The purer form, we are doing it. How are we doing it? We are associating this I to nobler things, and we are acting accordingly, which is the rajas aspect, as Swami would say. So you are actually sublimating this ego. We cannot one day get up and say that, okay, the ego is the problem. I need to have self-respect and not ego. So let me do away with ego. It doesn't work that way. So we use the ego to sublimate the ego. And how do you do that is, as Swami has beautifully explained, that, you know, you associate it with something which is more noble and you act towards that so that the tamasic aspects of ego don't show up. So from all that I've said so far, how do we view the idea of criticism, right? That is one of the other important questions that was asked, I mean, other important aspects of the question that was asked. How does criticism fit into all this? And how do we view criticism on the basis of whatever we've seen so far about the idea of self-respect? There was, again, an entire episode that I had done on how do you deal with criticism. So I will not repeat all that I've said there. But for this particular topic, as I mentioned, partly it is important to counter in criticism because it helps us define our role. So we must be open to criticism. It's not like, you know, I am leading a life of self-respect, so I don't need to take feedback from outside. I'm not going to entirely view myself based on others' criticism. My reference is always going to be my conscience. So when someone criticizes me, I take the time to ask how true that criticism is and how much of that criticism I need to factor in so that I can define my role better, right? Most of us, I think we all take criticism personally. I don't think any of us can say that we don't take it personally. I think the moment somebody comes and tells us something very critical or something, even something not so critical, but they tell it a little harshly, I think we immediately take it personally. Right? So if I'm a person who is only bothered of who I think I am, what will I do? I will immediately defend myself. I will say that, you know, this person is doesn't like me, and so he's saying this or she's saying this. This person is trying to put me down, and that's why they're saying this. So I completely cut myself off from that criticism. This is if I'm only bothered of who I think I am. If I'm a person who is only bothered about what others think of me, then I will take this criticism too very deeply, and I'll get demoralized, and I'll probably, you know, I'll be down in the dumps. So these are both extremes that we have to avoid. Because we are not completely centered or balanced, when someone criticizes, we naturally, I think, will either react in this defensive manner, or we'll completely lose our confidence when somebody comes and criticizes. So the best thing that we need to do is take a little bit of time and analyze. See the changes that are happening in our mind. Ask, am I being too attached to my self-image that I'm not open to this feedback? Or am I giving so much importance to others' words that I'm getting demotivated, right? Once we start doing this self-analysis, I think we'll be in a better position to know how genuine that criticism is, because most often the criticism that comes from outside can be very, very constructive. And even if that person who's giving the criticism is doing it with malified intent, it doesn't matter. If that criticism is going to be useful for us to define our roles, why not? Even if it's coming from a person who's trying to put us down, if we are able to take the time and say that, look at that criticism objectively, remove that personality from where that criticism is coming, and just look at that criticism saying that, do I need to take any lesson from this? If it is not, it can be discarded, right? So it's always important to take that time off and do the self-analysis. And if you feel the need to explain, I think you may do so. When you start explaining your position, you will not explain to earn the respect from the other person, but you will genuinely explain from your standpoint to clarify from where, you know, your actions have come. So if the one who is criticizing is really criticizing you genuinely, I think he or she will see where your explanation is coming from, and probably they will change their stance. If not, I think it doesn't matter. I mean, you've just given it a try. You have not given that explanation to earn that other person's respect. You have purely done it to explain a situation. So it doesn't matter how that person will react. If you really feel you've done the right thing and there is no necessity to explain, or explaining is not going to help the situation at that particular point, you can again leave it, because, you know, you're explaining yourself not because that other person should respect you, or you're supposed to protect your self-respect through that explanation. You are going to look at your explanation only as, is it going to better the situation we are in? Because especially when we're working in a team, when we're working with colleagues, you know, it is important to even maintain that environment where we all can work together. So we are not looking at defending our self-respect, because our self-respect actually does not really depend on what others think of us. That's something which will eventually come when we have lived a life of self-respect. You know, that is like the indication, as I was saying. You're not at all bothered about that. So you're purely looking at criticism as, is there any input I need to take from this? Is there any feedback I need to take from this? So will explaining help the whole team and the work that we are doing is what you will be focused on, not whether this will improve my self-respect or will defend my self-respect. So when through analysis, we can control our ego. It is always there till the point when we are completely egoless and we are associating ourselves only with the true self. There will be a little bit of ego. So you take your time off. And when you realize that, you know, I am becoming defensive because of my ego, or I am becoming demoralized because I am dependent so much on what others think of me, you will be able to stop and say that, okay, this is where the problem is. This is what I'm doing. And you can counter it by, you know, suppose it's your ego and you're becoming defensive. You can force yourself to go and tell that person, I think I was wrong. I'm really sorry. That is one of the ways by which you're countering this ego. Or if you feel that you're getting demoralized unnecessarily, then you take the time to say that, you know, actually it doesn't matter. You know, this, why should I be so bothered about what that person thinks of me? It is not necessary. I'm doing it the right way. I think I'm doing it. And I'm sure I'm doing it in accordance to my conscience, so I need not be worried about what the other person is saying. In conclusion, what I want to tell is something which Swami had once told a few of his devotees when he was explaining to them about spiritual exercises and spiritual sadhana that we performed. Swami asked them that, you know, you've been doing sadhana for so many years. Why is it that you have not progressed as much as you should have given the amount of sadhana that you have performed? And then Swami went on to explain, see, that is because with sadhana, you must also do self-analysis. Swami said, initially when you start your sadhana, you can say that 75% of your time is given to sadhana and 25% of the time is given to this idea of this process of self-analysis. But now that you have done for so many years the sadhana, you must do 25% of sadhana and 75% of self-analysis, right? And then Swami explained what is this self-analysis, and this self-analysis is nothing but what we've been talking about of how you take your time and start looking at your mind. Because Swami said, you start observing your mind, you observe your reactions, you observe the responses that you give, what you say, what you do, how you react when someone comes and tells you something harsh, how you react when somebody comes and praises you. So Swami said this self-analysis is very, very important, right? On one hand, we must do our sadhana, the japam, the dhyanam, the bhajans, the satsangs that we are being part of, the listening to the right things, the reading of the right things, right? This will make us gravitate towards the idea of that true self. What I said, you know, from what I think I am and what others think of me, I'm gravitating towards the true self through this process of sadhana. But we will also need to do this analysis from time and again to see where from this anger is coming from, where from this elation is coming, where from the demotivation is happening. So for that, in that sense, this criticism, the failure that we face, the bad name that comes to us without we actually deserving it, or the failures, I mean, the losses that we face, these are all very, very useful because these all trigger some kind of responses in our mind. And that is when we are given this opportunity to stop and analyze us. So someone will criticize, and the moment someone criticizes us, we will be able to pause and analyze and say that, no, this is not right. I am operating from the ego, or I am doing this out of my self-defense. So this is wrong. I should not be doing that, right? So even if I am messing it up at that particular situation, there's nothing wrong in that, because as I said, till the point we are perfect, there will be body consciousness, there will be ego, and we will take criticism personally, we will react sometimes in that moment, and we do act egoistically. So one thing is we'll be able to stop and analyze it, and it will be a good way to see where these things are coming from. We will be able to counter it. And the other important thing is, you know, all through this, the sadhana is also important. Because if you don't do the sadhana, and if I do only the self-analysis, suppose tomorrow you come and criticize me and say that this was something wrong with the way you did your program. And if I've not done the sadhana, I will not be gravitating towards the idea of the true self in diminishing my ego. I will do the self-analysis and I'll come back and say that, no, I was right. You know, you were wrong. Right? So that sadhana is also important. But along with that sadhana, this self-analysis is also very, very important. So this is what I thought I'll tell you. I know it's a very, very long drawn explanation, but none of these things are black and white in that sense, that self-respect is good or ego is bad, or this needs to be thrown out and this needs to be kept. Whatever we are is what we are, and where we have to reach has to be reached using whatever we are right now, right? So if we have an ego, there is a process by which that ego has to be used. If we have self-respect, which is imperfect, there's a process by which this self-respect needs to be made perfect. And all of this is what Swami says as spiritual sadhana. So on one hand, we are doing sadhana, which takes us closer to the real self. At the other hand, we are constantly trying to perfect this, do the self-analysis to use all of these unpleasant situations that we are in, be it criticism, be it bad name, be it failure, be it we're doing something and the tanking or whatever it is, we use all of these situations to go into the self-analysis. So along with sadhana, we are also ensuring that where is our responses coming from, so that it gives us an opportunity to work on that. So thank you, sister, for asking this question. I hope I've given a little bit of clarity. If you have anything more to ask, feel free to write to me. I'll be happy to explain further. So with that, dear listeners, let me quickly wind up. I've taken a little more time. Thank you for being with me. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. If you have a question that you would like me to feature on this program, you have to send me your question to prem@radiosaya.org. That's prem@radiosaya.org. That's my personal mail ID. So your mails will be read only by me. If you can record your questions and send it in your own voice, that would be more than perfect. Like today, I can play the question in your voice and then answer it. I'm going to play for you a very beautiful and very profound shloka on the other end of this particular musical rendition. You'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last segment of today in the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Book.
Manobudhyahankar Chetaninaham नच श्रोत्र जेहे नच घ्राण नेत्रे नच व्योम भूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम न च प्राण संयो न वे पंचवायु न वा सप्त धातु न वा पंचकोशः नवा पाणी पादो न चोपस्थ पायो चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम न मे द्वेष रागो न मे लोभ मोह मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्य भावः न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्षः चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम चिदानंद रूप शिवोहम शिवोहम न पुण्यम न पापम न सौख्यम न दुःखम न मंत्रो न तीर्थम न वेदान यज्ञ अहम भोजनम नैव भोज्यम न भोक्ता चिदानंद रूपः शिवो